brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's nuts to think that we've done 80-odd episodes of this podcast without having the legendary Mike Hutchinson on, but what better time than now to rectify that? Mike's best known for his dystopian stock car racing classic, Gaslands, as well as another much-loved title in this corner of the hobby, A Billion Suns, a game about a very prolific sperm donor. There's a couple of great interviews with Mike on the Paint All the Minis podcast that get into his hobby origin story, as well as extensively covering those aforementioned games. On this episode, though, I wanted to use our time wisely to talk about his new rank and flank fantasy game, Hobgoblin, his work on creating a miniature agnostic list building version of chess, and his excellent Rule of Carnage podcast, a masterclass in game design, which has led to Mike and co-host Glenn being signed up by a publisher to write a textbook on the subject. Let's find out more.
Me and my buddy Glenn, who did a lot of work together on my games Gaslands and A Billion Suns, and Glenn does his own board and card games through Kickstarter, and he's just lining up his first miniature games this year. So we used to spend a lot of time chatting rubbish about miniature games design and games that we liked and mechanics that we liked, mostly when we were in the car on the way to like gaming events and, you know, conventions around the UK. And then when lockdown came, we lost that opportunity, but we really still wanted to regularly be talking nonsense about games. So we thought, well, let's try putting it on the internet. And we started up Rule of Carnage as a set of just conversations about topics that were of interest to us. And it started off being more about the games that we were working on. And then it got more and more like specific topics within the realm of designing better miniature games. Yeah, and then not that long after we started, maybe a year in, and we had like the sum total of about 350 subscribers on YouTube, we got an email from a honest-to-goodness actual academic publisher called CRC Press. It's part of Taylor & Francis. They said, our textbooks on video game design are doing very well, thank you very much, but we're looking to expand into more tabletop game design stuff. Would you guys be interested in putting a proposal together? And we said, yeah, definitely. And my wife is an academic, so she knows how these things get structured, and so she helped us put together a convincing looking proposal, which they accepted. And fast forward, I think 2 years, we just finished and handed in 100,000 words of advice about how to design miniature games, and I think it will be published next year. We haven't actually got the final publication date yet, but yeah, it's called The Fundamentals of Tabletop Miniature Games Design, A Designer's Handbook by me and Glenn.
Yeah, really exciting stuff. I mean, I'm always caveating this with the fact that I'm not a games designer at all, but like any other hobbyist, I dabble in, you know, bits of scenario creation here and there, and maybe tweaking a rule set here and there, and your show has just really got me, you know, it's got me thinking about loads of stuff that I'd just never considered before. I think that combined with the conversations that I've had with Joe McCulloch as well, who I know you're good pals with, just that overall ethos. And I think you did hear, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I did hear you saying as well that this handbook, it's not so much here's exactly how to do it, but here's what to think about and sort of stirring that creativity up in folks. Is that accurate?
Well, so yes, I think what it is we sort of, as part of the podcast, we've created a Discord community for the Rule of Carnage. And quite often people will come into the community and they'll basically be like, well, look, I'm enjoying the podcast, but I want, you know, a book to get stuck into. Is there anything that you can recommend about, you know, to read about these kinds of games? And the answer is not really. There's only one book, and it's called, it's Rick Priestley's book, and it's called Tabletop War Games. And it's more about how you write a rule book and how you write the rules down in words. It's less about actually how to design the games and how to put the rules together in the first place and how to kind of create the alchemy of miniature games design. And more than that, I think, the more Glenn and I thought about tabletop miniature games, the more we realized that there isn't really a sort of grand unification theory of them. There isn't really a core understanding of what it is that makes a miniature game a miniature game. Why is a board game with miniatures not one of these games that we make? And what is it about these games that we make that define them? And so we spent a lot of time debating and trying to figure out kind of how to define them at their core. And so there's a sort of first third of the book is about that, in a way that we hope sort of allows people to think much more sideways about miniature games and open up the design space by saying, well, actually, it's not about replicating war and tactics in war necessarily. It's about the physical relationships between objects on the tabletop and those like spatial relationships and the pressure that their interaction ranges create. Like, that's where the magic of these games happen. And so how, if we have an abstract language for talking about that, how can we think about... Anyway, like, yeah, I'm super excited about the book basically being a sort of... just a more fundamental sort of set of concepts that we can then apply to miniature games. And I hope it's not like, then it goes into the much less airy fairy world of like, okay, how should melee combats work, or how should ranged combats work, or more to the point, like, what are the ranges of mechanics that you can use to represent each of these, you know, melee, movement, morale, what are the range of options available to you, and what might be the pros and cons of choosing one approach over another. And as we talk about in the podcast and we talk about in the book repeatedly, like, there is no correct rule in any situation. There is only what's the right alchemy of rules for your particular design goal, for your particular game. And no particular approach is ever going to be better or worse, like, universally. It's just contextually better or worse depending on the game you're trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, I would compel the listener, if they're not already subscribed, to check out Rule of Carnage, because I'm sure you'll have updates. I know that at this point in time, you don't have a specific timeline or publish date, so I'm assuming that'll be a great place to keep up to date with all that, yeah?
Indeed, yep.
One other thing that we can't not talk about, of course, is Hobgoblin. I'm very excited to be following along with this project since I learned about it. And it has its origins quite far back in your sort of games designing career now, doesn't it? But, I mean, how does it feel to be on the cusp of getting that out there into the wild?
Yeah, so Hobgoblin is, for those that don't know, Hobgoblin is my most recent game that just got released digitally, and the physical copies have just landed in my house this week. In fact, I published a YouTube flip-through video this morning of me looking at the rule book for the first time as we record this. Hobgoblin is a rank and flank fantasy battle game that I have been working on and off for nearly 9 years, and I'm super excited to finally get it out. And I'm super excited to be talking about it on particularly podcasts such as yours. So, like, if people have fantasy miniatures and they have played fantasy games in the past, whether that's, you know, more modern sort of warbandy things like Age of Sigmar, or, you know, Warhammer Fantasy Battle and Kings of War and so on, my game is a rank and flank fantasy battle game that, as we can talk about, like, it's absolutely obsessed with a particular kind of game experience, and I wanted Hobgoblin to be brutally fast and extremely kind of exciting and quick to play, so that you can get all of your miniatures on the table and see them all die in glorious battle.
I mean, the game itself, you talked about this you know, the speed of play, if you like. You've talked a lot about that. You've also talked about, on your podcast, you've talked at length about the curse of the first and potentially second turns in games like Warhammer Fantasy, where we're all just walking towards each other. And it sounds like you've made a good effort to try and eliminate that from Hobgoblin. Could you talk to us a wee bit about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So Hobgoblin... Hobgoblin is, so yeah, you're absolutely right. The specifics of that are that in Hobgoblin, your armies, which are essentially battle lines of ranked up units, but each unit is represented just by a footprint rather than a group of models clumped together. The battle lines start quite close together, so deployments are like essentially 16 inches apart. And to a degree, that is simply to essentially eliminate the first turn of moving around. And that's kind of a common theme in all of my games so far. So A Billion Suns is a spaceship game where you don't really have deployment zones. You just all like deploy crazily on top of each other as soon as the game begins. And so the game starts in a kind of chaotic swirl of close range combat. And in Gaslands, particularly if you play the Death Race scenario, like everyone starts on a starting grid all bunched together already. And what I like about that in all three cases is that the game just starts, you've got player interaction almost immediately. And so the game doesn't hang around waiting for the action to start. It just fast forwards. It's a bit like a cold open in a TV show. It just cuts right to the action. But it is a deliberate design decision that's also pressing home the idea that this is a game that's, you know, as much about like pressing forward into combat and getting stuck in immediately, rather than necessarily a more like take a lean back strategic view of the battlefield. Like, you do have to take a strategic view to a degree, but like having more time to maneuver in the first couple of turns, as you do in most other rank and flank games, gives that a certain kind of strategic feel, which I'm trying to, like, all of the rules in Hobgoblin are trying to push into a more chaotic feel and a more immediate feel. So it's again, it's not that I think starting further back and having an extra turn of movement is wrong. It's just that in Hobgoblin, we don't do it because we're trying to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, you've kind of alluded to this already, but what are some of the key things that you think, or you've maybe heard already based on feedback, that people are going to get from playing Hobgoblin that they don't get when they're, you know, playing a game maybe like Warhammer or Kings of War, etc.?
Yeah, so there's sort of two main things that I'm excited about, and they kind of come from slightly different places. The first thing that's for me important about Hobgoblin is that I wrote Hobgoblin so that I could put any gosh darn fantasy miniature I wanted on the table and have a good time with it. So I have a lot of painted monster miniatures, which tends to be kind of rubbish in quite often in the other games that they're intended for. And I like creating units of miniatures based on what I think looks coolest, rather than worrying too much about what the best thing in the game system is. And that's kind of tripped me up a few times in other game systems. And so what I've done with Hobgoblin is essentially sort of separated out the hobby part of your army building from the rules bit of your army building, which is slightly weird, but it's because what I want to do is paint anything that I think looks cool and then figure out how to make it work for me on the table. And the way that that's achieved is that every unit in Hobgoblin gets assigned by you at army building time a unit type. So it might be light infantry, heavy infantry, light cavalry, chariot, monstrous infantry, blah, blah, blah. And that provides a sort of standard way that it can attack and be attacked by the other unit types. And there's a sort of rock, paper, stone relationship across the 13 unit types, so that every unit type has something that it's good against and something that's poor against, and everything has its role on the battlefield. And that means that if I've got a cool monster miniature, I just put it on the table and I say, cool, that's going to be a monster. And that's the same as all of the other monsters, which provides a kind of baseline. Everything's just sort of fine. But to provide some flavor and some variation, then when you're building your army, you can also add strengths and weaknesses. And those strengths and weaknesses increase or decrease the cost of the unit. And so you can kind of tweak the units to have the sort of rules that you think describe the kind of the kind of character of that model inside your imagination of the world. And so that, like, that's the first sort of real heart of the game, is I want to give everybody the opportunity to play with whatever miniatures they want. And also that if they build an army and they spend ages painting a particular unit, and they build it with crossbows and paint that unit, and then it turns out, oh, they really wish they had the slightly longer range, and they kind of wish they built it with the longbows or whatever. In Hobgoblin, you don't have to worry about that. Like, you just attach the rules to the unit, and then for the next game, if you didn't like the way the game, the army worked, you can just change the rules. Just, you know, swap the strengths and weaknesses around, or even change the assignment of the unit type. So instead of it being
a light infantry with, you know, with elites, you could say, well, actually, let me try it with as a heavy infantry and see if that fits the feeling better. So it's kind of almost like building a Magic the Gathering deck. Like, you're constantly able to iterate your army list to tweak it to so that the behavior on the table, the sort of gameplay, matches the way that your imagination works, or the way that you like to play armies. And so it's weird because it sort of separates the miniatures and the rules, but at the same time, for me, it sort of harmonizes them in a way that few other systems let me do, that I can just build what I want and then I can have a really cool gaming experience with them, and nothing about those two sides is fighting with each other.
Is it an exclusively 28 mil game, or could we do it at 15 or even smaller?
It's nothing about it is 28 mil specific, so lots of people in the Hobgoblin community are playing it at 15, 10 and 6, and it plays absolutely fine. I've played it in 10 mil a fair bit, and even in 6 mil. I have a 6 mil goblin and sort of empire style armies. Yeah, because what it is that in the rulebook, Hobgoblin just describes some minimum and maximum footprints for different unit types, and units are basically either narrow and they're sort of on things that look a bit like chariot bases, or they're wide and they're on like what you would recognize as a sort of Warhammer or Kings of War shaped unit footprint. But they're quite flexible. So if you've got an old hammer army that's, you know, filled with small units of sort of 5 and 10 models, those will fit within Hobgoblin, no problem. If you've got much larger sort of 8th edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle armies that got, you know, 7 ranks wide and 5 deep and stuff, like those will fit as well, although you might have to buy them the Horde strength to represent their even larger footprint. And if, like me, you've got lots of fantasy miniatures on round bases, you know, it's easy enough to buy conversion trays with little round holes, or just, you know, gather them together on squares of cardboard, so that you can essentially, like, as part of this, like, wanting anything that you paint to be good and welcome in Hobgoblin, I also don't want you to rebase anything. So because of that, you know, you can scale those footprints down or up or down. And so people in 10 mil will just, you know, halve the footprints and say, well, as long as it's within half the footprint, then we've got a legal unit in 10 mil.
Great stuff. I've got a few of the movement trays myself that are, you know, it's a rectangle, but it's full of wee round holes. So that's really useful. Loads of options for getting that on the table. Talk to us about the Games Expo Awards. Is that some recognition for the game already?
Oh, yes. Thank you for bringing it up. Yeah, so I'm officially multi-award winning as of last week. So at the UK Games Expo, which is, for those that are abroad and don't necessarily know, it's the biggest tabletop gaming convention in the UK. It's held in Birmingham annually, and it's role-playing games, and it's mostly board games, but there's lots of miniature games there as well, and it's a big industry event. Anyway, they do awards annually, and in 2018 I was lucky enough to win Judge's Choice for best miniature rules for Gastlands, and this year I've been lucky enough to win the Judge's Choice for best miniature rules for Hobgoblin, which is very exciting.
Congratulations for that, Mike. Did you get any feedback from anyone about what really caught their eye, or was it a vote thing? Like, how did it kind of work?
At Salute, one of the lovely chaps who's on the judges panel wandered past, and obviously Salute's kind of noisy, but we had a brief conversation, and he was excited by the elegance and snappiness of the rules, and also like really taken by the layout of the book and the crispness of the design and how kind of modern and fresh the whole thing felt. So yeah, that was the feedback I got. And I was just super delighted because there's some interesting competition in the nominations, particularly Chris McDowell's The Doomed was also nominated. And he and I had spoken only days earlier on his podcast, the Bastion Land podcast. So we're friends. So that was a friendly competition, which of course I'm very pleased to have crushed him.
you're certainly in fine company there. But I, like I say again, congrats as well, and good job with the crushing. I'm sure we'll not leave the topic of Hobgoblin entirely, but I'm just curious. You say you've got copies in your house now. Like, what's the next step for distribution, and when could folks just go out there and buy a copy in the conventional sense? You know, like Amazon.
Yeah, I am not 100% clear on the timelines. I know the books are in the distribution centers, and so the people who supported the game on Kickstarter should be getting those shipped out very soon. I think that means kind of like a couple of weeks away, but I'm not close to the actual distribution. And then from there, Alecti Studio, which is a fairly new company, emerged from the ashes of our work on the Blaster anthology. Greg Horton, who was the really talented graphic designer layout guy, he had such a fun time working with us on Blaster that he started his own games company, Alecti Studios, and so he's in the process of spinning up relationships with distributors in North America and UK and Europe to get this book into hobby shops. So I'm hopeful because he's working hard on that, but because it's a new publisher, it's all a little bit like sort of working it out as we go along. I'm going to be selling a bunch of copies at UKGE, so that's probably the only place that you can get it in the UK physically right now, but you can order it direct from Alecti, and distribution is coming. Before we move away from Hobgoblin, the other thing that I wanted to talk about a bit, because it relates to your question about why do armies start so close together in Hobgoblin, is that I started the design of Hobgoblin with this idea that I wanted to play with any miniatures that I wanted and make sure that they were good in Hobgoblin. But having started the game design with that, it turned out, as I sort of returned to the game having agreed to publish it with Greg and Alecti, I came back to the game and I started playing it, testing it, and trying to figure out what needed work. And I realized that this idea that there was a rock, paper, scissors relationship between the units and any model that I painted was welcome in Hobgoblin was good, but it didn't actually tell me what the game was supposed to feel like. So the subtitle I hit on fairly early on in the process, which is the subtitle of the game is Brutal Fantasy Battles. And so I came to this design principle quite early on that it should be brutally fast. And this phrase, brutally fast, really became like a watchword throughout the design. And that finally unlocked the second half of the design puzzle for me, which is like, what is the game supposed to feel like when you play it at the table? And so a lot of the design decisions, including, you know, why do armies start so close together? Or, you know, why is the combat resolution so simple? So the combat resolution system in Hobgoblin comes across as a little bit old school initially, but I think it works very, very nicely, which is basically all units just throw 10 dice, and what they need to hit is determined by looking up their unit type in a cross-reference chart with the target unit type. And that cross-reference chart does feel a little bit old-fashioned, but it means that I don't have to have any sort of martial skill comparison or strength and toughness comparisons or armor penetration. Everything about the relationship of is this unit good at smashing another unit is wrapped up into that target number chart. So you just roll 10 dice looking for whatever it is, fours or sixes or something. And any of those successes you fish out and you just dish doom tokens out onto the unit. And they don't get a saving throw. And the fact that they don't even get a saving throw is all part of this, like, how do you make it brutally fast? How do you make it really quick to resolve combat so that an entire game can play out as a sweeping battle line rather than as a set of little nitty-gritty, complex, detailed interactions between units? And the other part, I think, that the brutally fast thing pointed me in the direction of is making sure that everything that you do in Hobgoblin is pushing the game forward. So, for example, magic. The magic system is you get a bunch of resources, which are called Mercury tokens, and you get, depending on how big your army is and how many wizards you've got, you get some of those each turn. And if your units die, you also get them back as a consolation prize. You just spend those Mercury tokens to cast spells. There's no check to see if the spell works or not. It just does. And so it's a question of which spell do you cast, not whether you cast the spell. And equally, there's no dispel mechanic, which means there's no nope mechanic. And there's, in fact, no nope mechanics at all in Hobgoblin. Like, when you get attacked, you don't get a saving throw to say nope to those attacks. You just got to take your doom tokens and get on with it. And when spells are cast, you just got to deal with the fact that those spells have been cast. So everything's always barreling forwards. There's very little sort of, I try something, does it work? I block it, you know, kind of. That's a fine way for a game to work, but it's not the way that Hobgoblin works. It means that everything's barreling forward towards the conclusion of the game constantly. And that is something that I think is really exciting about Hobgoblin. And although when people come to the game, they might go, okay, so what's different about Hobgoblin to Kings of War in that it's got, you know, block units where you don't remove casualties? Or what's different to this from Dragon Rampant where you have unit types and, you know, the kind of generic unit types? And I think that my hope is to say that, well, once you get it on the table, you will see that it just plays very differently. It's very sort of, it's very brutally fast, and everything is barreling forwards to carnage and chaos. I should also say the last thing about the doom tokens is that sort of links back to the, you know, I want to be able to play with my monster models, thank you very much, is you take your doom tokens, but you don't die until the end of the turn. So it's only at the end of the turn that we find out if units are broken and they spread panic and then they get removed. So everybody gets to fight, even if you get, you know, alpha striked by a powerful unit or shot from across the table.
Yeah, I was really pleased to hear your conversations with Glenn on the podcast where you talked about this. You know, in some games, like, you're trying things and stuff just isn't happening. You know, it's a deadlock here, it's a deadlock there, and you just end up with a bit of pushing competition going on maybe. So it's really good to hear that there's an opportunity to play somewhere. Like you say, there's always momentum, we're always moving forward, we're always progressing, and we won't need 14 hours to get the game played as well. Is there anything else you'd like to cover on Hobgoblin that we've maybe not touched on before I go on to ask you about Chess 28?
I suppose just to say, yeah, Hobgoblin is out there digitally, so if you're intrigued, you can pick up a copy straight away. It is a big army game, but it doesn't ask you to have a specific number of miniatures, so you don't have to have big fantasy armies, but it is obviously a great excuse to get some miniatures that you will maybe have in your eye on. The other thing is that because the units are these big blocks, it's secretly sort of a skirmish game, because a big army in Hobgoblin will have like 8 to 10 to 12 units in it, and because they operate as single objects on the field, like, one of the secrets of those, of these kinds of games, is that actually you're still only dealing with sort of 12 models at maximum, which is, you know, not that many compared to, you know, when you think about how big a sort of medium-sized skirmish game. So don't be afraid of rank and flank. It is fun and it doesn't need that many models. And anyway, it's only 12.
Onwards to Chess 28 then. Talk to us a wee bit about that.
Yeah, so as part of our Rule of Carnage discussion, something bubbled out of one of our chats where the phrase chess but with list building came to me. And then that mutated in my mind to what if chess was miniature agnostic, which which seems to be a dumb idea that that was worth exploring. And I got really excited about this, and I got out a chessboard and I got out some old metal old hammer miniatures and some HeroQuest furniture, and I arrayed a sort of dungeon scene and started messing around with some mechanics. And as I progressed, I got excited about two things. One is, I actually felt quite strongly that this was an awesome thing that should exist in the world. And so I wrote a manifesto for Chess 28 to say that I actually thought that chess should be liberated from the millennium of having these same pieces and having these same rules and having this chessboard be a place of, you know, stoic learning and puzzling and so forth, and that we could do something much more exciting with this. I actually don't like chess very much. There's some specific reasons why I don't like chess very much from a game design perspective. I have never done the sort of study that one requires to become expert in chess, and I'm not denigrating the great act of learning to play chess, but I like playing with painted miniatures and having slightly more random times. So I created this Chess 28 manifesto that basically says, number one, chess has got to be miniature agnostic. It's got to have painted figures on it. Number two, It's got to have chance in it. It has to have dice or cards or something. Chess has got to have randomness. Chess 28 has got to have randomness in it. And number three, although it's called Chess 28, that's kind of a lie. Nothing's really 28 millimeters these days. So you can have any scale you want. If you want to put like tiny epic tanks on a chessboard and have some kind of Dune 2 or Command and Conquer situation, then great. That can still be Chess 28. And then I wrote the first Chess 28 game, which I called Flagstone, which is a fantasy sort of warband skirmish game where you've got a little warband of sort of 12-ish fantasy miniatures and I've got the same. And then we, in the initial scenario, we kind of try and battle across to the other side's back end in order to pummel a treasure chest in a scenario called Pinata. And I really was delighted by the system that I came up with for Flagstone. And so I went and did something else that I'd been kind of intrigued to do but hadn't done yet, which is open source something. So I took the initial kind of core system of Flagstone, which I call the Chess 28 core system, and I've made that available as a Creative Commons sort of use it and modify it as you like, as long as you give me some credit for its origin. Just to see if this idea of putting painted miniatures in a miniature agnostic way on a chessboard excited other games designers. And then if other hobbyists wanted to sort of create their own entire new games, they could just use the manifesto. But if they wanted an idea of where to start from, that they could also use my core system, and indeed they could make games based on it. So yeah, it's kind of a dumb experiment, but I am really excited by it and immediately started making scratch-built chessboards, which I've made three of now.
Aye, a really cool idea. I'm looking forward to checking that out. I don't hate chess. I don't mind it actually, but totally different than a miniatures game, obviously. So really interested to see how you've kind of tied it together. With the, you know, sticking the number 28 on the end of a game, obviously we've got like the 28 community, and I had an episode about the 28 magazine and community and stuff like that recently. And one of the, I know this is probably subject for an entire episode of its own, but one recurring theme I hear on 28's podcast, and yourself and Glenn have talked about this too, is like non-combat miniature games as well, because you know we're almost always fighting each other. But I mean, is that something you've given any thought to having a go at some point in the future?
It is. So my feelings on this are complicated because, broadly speaking, the short answer is I've tried loads of times and I haven't managed to find one that I am happy with and excited by. But if I can just like unload a few random thoughts on this, like number one, there's nothing about miniatures games, particularly what I refer to as like non-discrete miniature games with measurements, and you know, you can place anything in any number of spots in an infinity of arrangements, and you can, you know, use any kind of models and terrains and stuff. There's nothing in those games that necessitate direct combat. Like, it should absolutely be possible to create a like Regency ball game where, you know, the models are like, you know, the different kind of like eligible young women and eligible young men, and the, you know, the old army general and the old matriarch figure, and like they should all be, you know, a ranged attack would be how attractive I am, and a melee attack would be how witty I am. Like, nothing about that shouldn't work. But I have tried a number of these and I just haven't been able to find something that I'm excited by. And I wonder if that's because of, you know, so much history and background and expectations and sort of almost like genre tropes that we have inherited. Go ahead.
No, if you had more, go on, Mike.
I've got loads. If you've got, I'll move on. But if you've got some comment on that, I've got loads of other points I'll add.
Okay, my point wasn't that interesting. I was just going to say most of the miniatures that I have almost all of the miniatures I have are related to combat and fighting. I've got a few like peasants carrying pigs and stuff, but most of them have guns or swords.
No, and that's absolutely critical. Like, it's absolutely critical that like, we have a sort of running gag in the Rule of Carnage Discord, which is like every time we'll find an unarmed, particularly science fiction miniature, we'll share it because they're very, very rare. And so there is a practical consideration, which is particularly as an indie designer writing miniature agnostic games, like the miniatures that are out there, are the things that are available to you as a platform to design against. It's like sort of, you know, and so if it's difficult to get, you know, a collection of, you know, unarmed Regency ballroom miniatures in 28 so that we could play this game, then either you're going to have to design those miniatures yourself, which I don't know how to do, and then only offer them, you know, to 3D print enabled customers, or start your own miniatures companies, which I don't know how to do. And so there's definitely a limitation in the physicality of like what's available. But, you know, obviously the 3D printing revolution will and can and will change that. The other thing, another aspect, a third aspect that I think about a lot with regards to this is I read a book. I'm not going to be able to remember the name now. I think it's called Game On. I'm not sure. Anyway, it's a history of the video game industry that I read a couple of years ago. And there was a big transformation in the video game industry at the point when Facebook gaming kind of started to emerge and become massive. And mobile gaming, casual gaming also emerged around the same time. And there was sort of a global moment where video game designers and publishers went, oh, wow, there's an audience that isn't adolescent men that we could make games for. And they started making very different kinds of games and having an enormous sort of financial success from the fact that there was an untapped audience that just hadn't been given a product that was, you know, sort of designed and resonated with them. And, you know, obviously plenty of women play, you know, bloody first person shooters as well. But the point is that, like, right now, miniature games are kind of all bloody combat simulators, and they could be, you know, other things. They could be things that are much broader in their scope. And in role playing games and in board games, we see like just an enormous variety of subject matters, you know. Board games will cover all kinds of things. You know, it's actually kind of niche to have bloody combat in a board game. But miniature games haven't done it. And I think that, you know, all of this work about non-combat games and the people in, you know, there's a great Discord server called Non-Combat Games, and all of the work and thinking that's being done is important, and we should try and get them to work. But my feelings are complicated because I haven't been able to make it work, and I would like to be a champion of these things existing, but I just haven't managed to make it work yet. But I think that if you are thinking about it, this idea of like what is the equivalent of a ranged action if it isn't a gun, and what is the equivalent of a close action if it isn't a knife, and sort of working on those basic things definitely is a starting point.
Necromunda with Napoleon, Frostgrave with Florence Nightingale, or Battlemasters with Barry Gibb. Our question of the month for September 2024 is, which person, dead or alive, would you love to play a miniatures game with, and why? And also, what game would you play? Record your audio clip by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and I need them in by Friday the 27th of September. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show. Want to switch gears a wee bit and ask you, I mean, we've talked about, you know, you're bringing another brilliant game out, you've won an award and stuff, but a bit of a deep question. I was just wondering, like, what's been your lowest point as a games designer over the past few years?
So I have talked about kind of recently, I've had a bad year, and I'm coming out of that, but the summer of 2023, I suffered a pretty significant moment of what I now realize was occupational burnout. So a little bit of history about me. So I haven't been a full-time games designer before this year. It was just something that I did in my spare time, as most of us do. And I had a full-time job being working in the software industry, working for London tech startups and you know, working kind of stressful long hours. And then I got the good fortune of the company that I was working for got acquired by Epic Games, makers of Fortnite and the Epic Games Store. And at that point, like, my life, kind of my work life, sort of accelerated and intensified enormously. And I was at Epic for 3 years. And halfway through the third year, I just I just broke. Like, I came back from, it was the end of May last year, and I came back from my third business trip to America, and I got home and I just like slept for 72 hours and I was really sick and had chest pains and had anxiety attacks and was just like weeping uncontrollably, angry at the children, angry at my wife, like just completely outside of myself. And I had no idea what was going on. And it was sort of awful and terrifying, and took a few weeks off work, which turned into a few months of really quite bad sort of disengagement from everything. I couldn't read books. I couldn't write. Like, I had to contact both publishers that I was working for. I had to contact them and say, look, I have to push my deadlines back by 6 months. I'm not in a state to work right now. And so I know this is kind of a heavy answer, but the reason I wanted to bring it up is that having experienced occupational burnout, I took the time to learn more about what the symptoms and causes of occupational burnout are. And I sort of want to be talking a bit about it because I think that my experience was worsened by the fact that I didn't know about what the symptoms and causes were. And so when I found myself in a place where I was unable to work and unable to focus, and that I felt like angry and cynical in a way that I've never felt before, and generally unwell in myself, I thought that something was kind of wrong with me or had gone wrong with me. And learning that occupational burnout is well documented and has these things that are kind of temporary side effects or symptoms of that sort of helped me step back and say, okay, this isn't me that's broken. This is something that's happening to me right now that I will be able to get out the other side of. And also learning about what it was that had probably led to that situation was useful because, and there's a very, very phenomenal talk on the GDC YouTube where one guy is talking about the causes of burnout. And there are six factors that are documented about why you might get to a point in your life through work or through general life about being burnt out. And they are printed out and stuck on my wall so that I make sure that I keep an eye on them. But they're things like your workload, the control over your environment, the sort of sense of community, fairness, and whether the people around you share your values. And the point being that all of the things that can lead to burnout are essentially outside of your direct control. They're not things where, you know, if you take the time to, you know, to go for a walk or to meditate or to, you know, do self-care things, that you'll fix these problems. These are kind of problems that tend to be surrounding you in whatever environment you're in or company you're working for. And that in itself was helpful because I hit this wall last year and there was a sense of kind of guilt or failure that like, oh, how have I got myself into this situation? And then it sort of helped to understand, well, actually this was an environment that was wrong for me, and I needed to change the environment, not sort of change my own behavior. Anyway, that fast forwarded a decision that I was kind of umming and ahhing about for many years, which is, you know, this game design stuff is going well, should I take the risk to go full time? And so having had that experience, I was like, yeah, I'm going to spend 6 months trying to get back on my feet, but at the end of the year, I'm going to take the risk and I'm going to go full time, and we'll see whether that is the thing that delivers a new and calmer lifestyle. And so that's what I've done. And, you know, things are still fixing themselves slowly. I'm not back to where I was kind of productivity and energy and cheerfulness 3 years ago, but I'm really excited about the new adventure of being my own boss, doing 100% games design all the time. And obviously things like my new game winning an industry award is massive to, you know, to sort of drive my drive my profile and make it more likely that I can do these things full time and make it work beyond the sort of year's worth of money that I've got saved up to do this experiment. So yeah, sorry, that was a bit of a heavy answer, but
No, I'm glad you were able to speak about that. And yeah, it's great to hear that. I mean, I know these things, they don't fix overnight, but, you know, it sounds like you're working towards a good place.
I think that was one of the things that learning about this stuff was so important, because listening to other people's stories and then talking about a sort of a healing horizon of like 1 to 2 years, it was like, oh, okay, this isn't something that's going to get better next week. I just need to give myself time. And that that sort of understanding and permission was, you know, it's important because then you're not beating yourself up about something that isn't going to fix itself as fast as you would like.
We talk a fair bit in this hobby about mental health and about the fact that, you know, a lot of people, almost all of us, are using it to escape. And obviously you're not new to writing games, but you're new to this being a full-time position. Can that intrude on the sort of escapism, you know, that if that was somewhere you found comfortable to go in your own head, is it different now that that is your, you know, your primary career?
I was really worried about this question because, you know, you always hear it, don't you? Don't make your hobby your work, because then your hobby's your work. I mean, I just do hobby all the time now. It's brilliant. Like, I was a bit stressed before Salute because I hadn't finished enough Hobgoblin armies for two tables worth of demos. So, like, it was my job to sit down for a week and finish two fantasy armies. That's brilliant. I love painting fantasy armies. So right now, the answer is no. It just feels like I get to do the thing that I love all the time. You know, maybe ask me again in a year whether some of that stuff has started to feel like work. But, you know, I think it's given me a real energy to say, well, these things that I would want to do anyway, I can just be a bit more strategic about which ones I choose. So, for example, like, I've put all my Games Workshop models away, and I might even sell them all, because painting a Games Workshop model is, I can't use that model in photographs, or I can't use it when I'm going to demo the game at events. But if I just chose to paint, like, you know, a Bestiarium model or a one-page rules model, then I can use those because I've got relationships with those guys. And so it certainly changed a little bit about how I approach my hobby in terms of what I select, what I choose to do. But even that, like, you know, I'm a serial collector of all models from all kinds of manufacturers. I don't know if you're the same as me, but I love wandering around Salute and picking up all these weird models that I kind of feel like I'm only going to be able to get at that. It's that, like, you know, when back in the day when GW had blister packs and you never knew what you were going to find in each shop, and it was always a little sort of scavenger hunt and a little lucky dip. And I still love that, but I get that feeling from independent manufacturers of miniatures. And so yeah, I don't know. No, I think is the answer, but I hope it stays that way.
Well, that's good to hear. You mentioned on your podcast that you've got kids. How old are they, and do they play any games with you at all?
Yeah, they're 7 and 4, and they are, yes, they're being inducted. So the 7-year-old has fallen in love with the new HeroQuest. I bought in on the new Hasbro HeroQuest, and she's absolutely loving that. And my 4-year-old played some Gaslands with me only last weekend. We got out, I've written a sort of Gaslands kids mode called Ready, Get, Set, Go, which you can download from planetsmashergames.com, which makes the game much more simple, which she loved. And because I was getting a bunch of board games out, because I was doing some, I was getting a bunch of board games out for a reason, and she was really excited by all the different board games. And so we've played a couple of board games as of, you know, with my 7-year-old and my 4-year-old this week. We played we played The King Is Dead by Offspray, which is like a super strategic kind of middleweight Euro game, but these girls were just like, oh yeah, okay, we could put little squares down and pick them up and all that kind of good stuff. And they love playing Splendor because it's basically like going to a shop and you get some money and then you can spend the money on things. So yeah, I love playing games with my girls.
It's interesting to hear about HeroQuest, because I mean, obviously, like, our generation, there was a massive reason, you know, why we got into that, you know, the TV ads and stuff, and just the hobby wasn't as accessible then. But I do hear a lot of parents, whether through nostalgia or some other reason, they do play that with their kids, and the kids seem to like it. Do you think there's a reason kids seem to take to that game to this day? And I don't necessarily know if that's the newer version or the older version or just a mixture of both, but
I think it's the simplicity of it. I think it's an incredibly elegant game. I think nostalgia has caused us parents to foist it on the younger generation. But nostalgia is not why the kids are enjoying it. The kids are enjoying it because it's got this really simple mechanical system, and the act of opening a door and discovering something you know, where is the furniture going to be and which monsters are going to be in it, I think it's just genuinely delightful. And, you know, you see this all the time in roguelike video games and stuff, this idea of like pushing open the door and discovering what's in it. And obviously it's, you know, it's as old as the AD&D hills. But that I see is what my girls get out of it. They love this like act of discovery. But also because, you know, around the time I started playing HeroQuest with them, I was reading a bunch of OSR RPG books. So I was reading Old School Essentials was the one that I remember reading at the time. We took some of the ideas from Old School Essentials, from like original D&D, and started putting them into HeroQuest, because HeroQuest is all about murdering goblins. And so instead we added like a encounter role that finds out like are the goblins friendly or are they aggressive, and that allowed my girls to start having interactions. And so now, like, quite often when they walk in a HeroQuest room, if there is a table and there are green skins around the table, there is always a pot of smelly sock soup on the table. And then the question is, will the heroes try and bribe the goblins to get some of their soup, or will the goblins try and force them to drink it? Or, you know, it's it's great.
I just keep thinking about, like, I mean, again, like I say, I don't make games, I don't design them, but I've always got wee scenarios in my mind, especially, you know, since I've been binging your podcast. Mm. And I've got the Dungeon Saga set, so I've got dungeon tiles and stuff, and I've been coming up with all sorts of wee things that I'm wanting to try. And one of them is just like, what if the four powerful heroes were the NPCs and I was just the baddies and I'm trying to throw everything at them?
Like Bullfrog's Dungeon Keeper.
I'm not familiar with that.
It was like a 90s isometric strategy game on the PC. Mm. And yeah, you were the dungeon master, and you like built your base up, and you had little imps that would mine out tunnels and collect resources. And then at some point a trumpet would blow and some dastardly heroes would come in and try and murder all your stuff and steal all your loot, and you were supposed to keep them out. It was great. We loved that game.
Another wee idea I've been toying with as well, and I think I'm kind of like distantly borrowing this for Billion Suns, but you know, when you're playing a dungeon game, a lot of them, it's like, you know, there's the door there, and then you get through the door, you realize that here's the next part of the board, the next part of the board. And I was thinking, what if I just set up 6 to 8 different rooms that, you know, are set up on the table, but they're completely independent of one another? And if we go for a kind of Lovecraftian cosmic horror vibe, when I go through a door, I could end up in any one of these other rooms, you know, and some of them are going to be quite easy. Some of them are going to be pretty impossible to get out of. So that's another wee thing I'm riffing on.
Yeah, that's
a
cool idea. Yeah, so it's sort of like they're connected by portals, but the portal routes are unpredictable. You'd roll each time, or maybe.
Exactly, yeah. And maybe, you know, you can't go back through the door you came. You have to go forwards. So you can't just get into a bad room and think, like, fuck this, I'm going back.
Yeah. The portal closes behind you.
Yeah, aye. And like every exit door you could basically end up on. But I'm trying to figure out how to make that work, because obviously if you're rolling, there might be one room you need to get to that you just never get to. So I'm not sure, maybe a deck of cards or something.
Tell me a little bit about Dungeon Saga, because I've not read it or played it. How does it play? What's your potted review of it?
It's really solid. I like it, but there were certain issues that weren't necessarily to do with the rules that have caused me not to play it much in its intended form. And part of that is space. Like, you know, if you're playing through these campaigns, a dungeon can get pretty big, it can get pretty sprawling, and I don't necessarily have the room to lay all that out. So I think I got it because I just really wanted the kit rather than the game itself, and that's no disrespect to the rule set, but I just like having a dungeon. You know, I like having the doors, the furniture. There was great models that came with it too, and that really bumped my collection up. You know, a lot of skeletons and zombies, you could never have too many of them in a dungeon, so...
Yeah, definitely. Because I'm a games designer, I also hoard bits and bobs like that. And I tell you something for free. On eBay, particularly the dungeon tiles from Cursed City, you can pick them up for dirt cheap. And this is true for most of the GW Box games. Like, I've picked up extra sets of the whatever that Gene Stealer versus Space Marines board game was, that's got like science fiction dungeon tiles. The dungeon tiles from the the Horus Heresy board game from way back, the Cursed Cities. Like, you can pick them up for like a fiver for all the dungeon tiles, because people buy the sets to paint the minis and sell the minis on, and so they're left with all this cardboard. And so if you're the kind of person that would like to mess around with dungeons, oh my goodness, you can pick up so much good cardboard for pennies.
Cool, great stuff. I'm respectful of your time, Mike, and I don't want to keep you much longer. I just wanted to say again, like, this has been a huge pleasure to chat to you. Really appreciate you coming on. It's really nice to hear that you listen to the podcast as well. Like I say, I was surprised at that. But any closing words, closing thoughts, or things that I've simply forgot to ask you about? Or
well, let me plug a bunch of things. So if you're interested in finding out what I'm up to, I have basically started posting very regularly on YouTube. So if you go over to Planet Smasher Games on YouTube, I do weekly dev diaries. So I kind of just share my process as I'm going along. It's fairly random and unstructured. So like whatever I'm working, whatever my brain has decided to do, I film some playtesting games where I'm exploring rule mechanics, or I talk about the games that I'm working on, or coming up soon is a game design talk on playtesting that I did with Joe at Canterbury Christchurch University nearby. So anyway, follow my YouTube channel. And the other thing you can do is go over to planetsmashergames.com and find out all the things that I'm up to and buy my games. And that's the third thing you should do, is buy my games. Certainly buy Hobgoblin and give it a go with your existing fantasy miniatures and have a good time.
Massive thanks to Mike there. Really, really enjoyable conversation. And I can't wait to get myself a copy of Hobgoblin and get my 15mm armies on the table at last. And if you're new to this episode, if this is your first time with us, then be sure to hit subscribe or follow on your listening app of choice. And there's lots of episodes in the back catalogue that I'm sure you'll be interested in as well. Remember, we've got a Discord. You could find that at bedroombattlefields.com/discord. And we also have a store with some Goblin Green branded merch, you know, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, magnets, that sort of thing. And you could find that at bedroombattlefields.com/store. Okay, that's all for now. Next episode, we're going to do the question of the month for May 2024 as well. So keep an eye out there, and we'll talk again once that comes out.